The following broadcast from the North Carolina Reading Service is intended for our audience of blind and print-impaired people. It's the Indie Week. I'm John Federson reading this week's issue of Indie Week, and it's dated December the 8th from 2020. And we'll head right into our issue, which begins this week with an article by Ricky Pointer, originally published in Charlotte, Queen City Nerve newspaper. A Protest for Everyone is an op-ed. As a disabled person who recently started talking publicly about deafness, disability, and inaccessibility on YouTube, at public speaking engagements, and through my writing, I've become more informed about human rights, especially mine in particular. Protests and marches have played a major role in the story of 2020, as a wider range of people have taken to the streets to make their voices heard. Unfortunately, these protests usually don't cater to those living with disabilities. As a deaf person, an ambulatory cane user due to chronic pain and fatigue, I worry about my and other disabled people's safety. Most protests I've attended or seen online have not had interpreters or any deaf-friendly resources. I was at a protest recently that featured multiple speakers, and I was unable to follow along. When a certain response was expected, I had to pay attention to my surroundings and try to keep up as best I could. And I would say, she parenthetically says, I would like to note, the following will be just about deaf and wheelchair cane using experiences. I can't speak for those who attend protests with other disabilities, as I don't have experience with anything beyond those issues. There is no plan available visually to let us know what to do in the event of an emergency. Deaf people, especially black deaf people, are more at risk for violence due to not being able to hear environmental noises or commands from police. Cane and wheelchair users typically are not safe due to the already inaccessible nature of cities. Many sidewalks and roads are filled with clutter or potholes. In the event that an emergency occurs, abled people will run in a hurry, potentially blocking and also knocking over anyone with an assistive device, which could cause injury. Sometimes disabled people feel straight up unwelcome. Two friends of mine, a wheelchair user and a cane user, were at the Women's March a few years ago, where they were met with abled women making hurtful comments toward them. It was also difficult for them to get around due to everyone taking over the sidewalks and leaving no room for them to get safely through. So, how can we make these events more accessible so that disabled people can take part? Of course, this may not be possible for all events. Protests can turn extremely dangerous extremely fast, but if it is possible, try to keep these things in mind. Hire interpreters, or if you're lucky, find an interpreter who's willing to volunteer for the event. Deaf people need access to information. It is critical. If you know American Sign Language or are at least willing to help your deaf peers out and be a buddy, consider making yourself known with some sort of sign. Bring a notepad and pen, or download a voice-to-text or live transcribing app onto your phone. If something happens, such as a gunshot noise, a dispersal order, or anything of that nature, find visual ways to let us know. And keep sidewalks and roadways as clear as possible when cane and wheelchair users are around. If you see someone blocking the way, let them know they need to move over. Creating a designated disability-friendly space for the march is a wonderful way to keep things going smoothly. In 2020, we still have many things and marginalized groups to fight for. We need to work together to uplift each other's voices and to keep each other safe. Disabled people are some of the most forgotten about people in the world, and that cannot stand any longer. Now to news from Tomasi McDonald, who has two different articles in this week's issue. tribal tension. North Carolina's Lumbee tribe took a step toward federal recognition in November, which is Native American Heritage Month. But before recognition can happen, they'll have to overcome opposition from the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians in western North Carolina. On November 17th, the Lumbee Recognition Act, sponsored by North Carolina Representative G.K. Butterfield, passed in the U.S. House. It's been referred to the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. Butterfield issued a statement calling the unanimous and bipartisan House vote a long-awaited victory for the Lumbee tribe and steps to right a historic wrong by extending the tribe full federal recognition. If the bill becomes law, Butterfield wrote, the Lumbee tribe will be a sovereign entity under federal law and have access to federal funding and services that will promote economic development, access to quality health care, and robust community empowerment. But just one day after the bill passed, Richard Sneed, principal chief of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, and Cyrus Benn, tribal chief of the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians, submitted a letter to the U.S. Congress opposing the Lumbee tribe's quest for federal recognition. Previously, after President Donald Trump promised to sign the current legislation into law, Sneed had implied that the Lumbees were poised to commit identity fraud. Melinda Maynor Lowry, a noted Lumbee historian and scholar, says the long struggle by the North Carolina Native American tribe to receive their due rights from federal and state governments should not be reduced to, quote, a soundbite about tribe versus tribe. In a series of tweets, Lowry said that opposition to the legislation is a conflict created by the federal government, quote, so they can avoid providing us with the acknowledgement of our sovereignty that we are owed. According to the Native American Rights Fund, only tribes who maintain a legal relationship to the U.S. government through binding treaties, acts of Congress, executive orders, and the like are officially recognized by the federal government. There are currently more than 550 federally recognized tribes in the United States, including some 200 village groups in Alaska. However, there are still hundreds of tribes, including the Lumbees, who are undergoing the lengthy and tedious process of applying for federal recognition. Sneed told NC Policy Watch last month, "We didn't invent these rules and this process. But we have played by the rules. We have respected the process. We expect other tribes to as well." Lowry, who is also the director of the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC Chapel Hill, said the process is harmful not only to the Lumbees, but also to the Cherokee and Catawba tribes. She tweeted, "To oversimplify this narrative, the U.S. government has subjected all of our communities to capricious and hypocritical formulations of identity, and then used those inaccurate definitions to acknowledge our sovereignty. This has been most harmful to Lumbees because it subjects us to judgment of our identity that other tribes haven't had to meet." The Eastern Band of Cherokee never had to meet a heritage or culture requirement to be acknowledged, but Chief Sneed insists that Lumbees do. This isn't correct. Days after Trump's October campaign visit to Lumberton, North Carolina, in which he vowed to support tribal recognition, Sneed issued a statement condemning, quote, political pandering regarding the Lumbee Recognition Act, and he wrote, "It's time to put an end to this charade. History and facts must guide the process, not politics. The purpose of federal recognition is to empower authentic Native people to protect and preserve their cultural identity, not to grant federal endorsement to large-scale identity theft." President-elect Joe Biden also said he would support full federal recognition for the Lumbee tribe. In a recent email to the Indy, Eastern Band spokesperson Ashley Stephens said leaders representing over 30 tribes across the United States have also voiced opposition to the legislation. And she writes, Sneed and Benn state in their letter that, "For over a century, the Lumbees have claimed to be Cherokee, Croatan, Siouan, Cheraw, Tuscarora, and other unrelated tribes, but have never been able to demonstrate any historical or genealogical tie to any historical tribe. Instead of demonstrating credible ties to historic tribes, they abandon one claim for another when challenges to their identity are asserted. Moreover, the leaders say the legislation circumvents a serious review of the Lumbee claims that its current membership has Native American ancestry. It is dangerous to pass legislation that short-circuits an established process designed to protect Native American history and identity. The tribal leaders say that Lumbees should instead pursue federal recognition through established processes administered by the U.S. Department of Interior, or where experts and procedures are in place, not through an act of Congress. The stakes are substantial, with tens of millions of dollars hanging in the balance for the Lumbees who live in some of the state's most impoverished counties. NC Policy Watch reported that federal recognition can be life-changing for tribes, with hundreds of millions in federal aid for housing, health care, and education for people who have faced government-sanctioned discrimination and genocide for hundreds of years. Their reporting also notes that federal recognition can unlock a much more powerful engine of economic change for Native American tribes with casino gambling on tribal land. During the past decade, when North Carolina lawmakers declined to take part in the federal expansion of Medicaid, the Cherokee took over the administration of health care for its members and created the Cherokee Indian Hospital Authority, using millions of dollars in revenue generated by the Harrah's Cherokee Casino Resort, which sits on its tribal lands. Nonetheless, Sneed and Ben claim that the cost of the bill, if passed into law, would exceed $1 billion and have devastating impacts on historical tribal nations that rely on federal funding for health care, education, and other services provided by the Indian Health Service and Bureau of Indian Affairs. Sneed said, "With enormous need across Indian country related to the COVID-19 response, reacquisition of land, protection of natural resources, and protection of Native women and children, federal swing state politics has overwhelmed sound federal policy and the priorities of tribal governments with whom the United States has treaties and trust relations. Today, the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians is a sovereign nation that covers 100 miles with more than 13,000 enrolled members." Historians report that no one knows exactly how long the Cherokee have lived in western North Carolina. The website CherokeeSmokies.com notes that artifacts discovered indicate people lived in the region more than 11,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age. Meanwhile, ancient Cherokee tales describe hunts of the mastodon that foraged there. In 1838, the U.S. government forced more than 16,000 Cherokee to walk to Oklahoma. The forced march, which led to an estimated one-quarter to one-half of participants dying, became known as the Trail of Tears. The Cherokees in the western part of the state today are descendants of those members who were able to hold on to their land or hide in the hills or who were able to return. Today, the 55,000-member Lumbee tribe resides primarily in North Carolina's Robeson, Hoke, Cumberland, and Scotland counties. According to the official Lumbee tribe website, it is the largest tribe in the state, the largest tribe east of the Mississippi River, and the ninth largest in the nation. The Lumbee take their name from the Lumbee River, which courses through Robeson County. Pembroke is the economic, cultural, and political center of the tribe. The Lumbee tribe website notes that its members are descendants of, quote, "the amalgamation of various Siouan, Algonquian, and Iroquoian-speaking tribes." Lumbee historians say the earliest document showing Indian communities in the area of Drowning Creek is a map prepared by John Herbert, the Commissioner of Indian Trade for the Winnow Factory on the Black River, in 1725. Herbert identifies the four Siouan-speaking communities as the Saraus, Pedee, Skavanos, and Wacomas. Today, Drowning Creek is known as the Lumber River and flows through present-day Robeson County. Many Lumbee people also know it as the Lumbee River. In 1885, the tribe gained recognition as Indian by the state of North Carolina, but its efforts to gain full federal recognition date back to 1888. The petition sought federal assistance for the tribe and its schools. That petition was denied due to a lack of funding by the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, according to the tribe's website. In 1956, Congress passed the Lumbee Act, which recognized the tribe as Indian, but nonetheless withheld the full benefits of federal recognition from the tribe. Prior to the legislation that's now before the Senate, bills were sponsored in 1988 by former U.S. Representative Mike McIntyre of Lumberton, and in 2003 by former U.S. Senator Elizabeth Dole of North Carolina. In an interview in April, Lowry, the historian, said tribal governments are often challenged to prove the legitimacy of their identity, and that it's hypocritical for others to tell them they don't belong. She said, "The idea of pure blood or pure ancestry or how much Indian are you is an outsider's way of making us disappear." The next article under the news heading by Greg Barnes was published in partnership with North Carolina Health News, and it's titled Piggy Bank. Elsie Herring is thrilled by a federal appeals court ruling last month that rejected most of the arguments presented by Smithfield Foods in a case that has pitted the world's largest hog producer against its mostly low-income black neighbors. Herring, 72, said she has been fighting how Smithfield raises its hogs since the 1990s. She has watched farmers spray fecal matter onto her mother's home in Wallace, North Carolina, she said, to the extent that, quote, "It rained down on us just like it was raining, and the smell was like nothing I have ever experienced." Over the years, Herring said, she wrote letters to everyone she could think of, state and federal regulators, the governor, the attorney general, state lawmakers, the county health department, anyone who might be able to stop the spraying, the awful smells, the flies, and the potential health hazards coming from the industrial hog farm next door. No one listened, she said. Instead, they retaliated. One time, Herring said the farmer next door came over waving a stick and warning her to stop making baseless complaints. Another time, she said the farmer's son barged into her then 98-year-old mother's home and shook the chair she sat in. Two other times, she said he threatened them with a gun. Herring said that when she complained to what was then the State Department of Environment and Natural Resources, she was told she could be forced to pay for the farmer's losses or be jailed for making baseless complaints. Herring, who is a plaintiff in one of the lawsuits, says she hopes they will listen now. She thinks the scathing November 19 ruling by the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond, Virginia, will finally make people understand the harmful impact Smithfield Foods has had on its neighbors. She said, "It's been long overdue, and is a glimmer of hope that maybe this is the road that will bring about some sustainable change that makes living in our homes enjoyable again, which is how it should be. Your home is your castle." The three-panel appeals court rejected most of Smithfield's arguments in the Kinlaw Farms case, the first of five nuisance lawsuits to go on trial in the U.S. District Court since 2018. In the Kinlaw case, the appeals court upheld a lower court's jury's decision that the 10 plaintiffs each be awarded $75,000 in compensatory damages, a sum that was reduced by a factor of 10 under a state law that caps awards. But the court also ruled that punitive damages awarded in the case, originally set at $5 million per plaintiff but cut in half under the same law, were unfairly weighted against Smithfield's corporate assets and must be reconsidered. Hours after the ruling was announced, Smithfield released a statement saying it had reached a settlement that would resolve the nuisance cases against the company. Smithfield would not divulge financial or other terms of the settlement, but it appears that it will extend monetary awards to the 10 plaintiffs in the Kinlaw Farms case, as well as the more than 500 North Carolina residents named in other lawsuits against the company. Whether the statement translates into hog farms becoming kinder, more thoughtful neighbors remains to be seen. Previously, lawyers for Smithfield had argued that the nuisance lawsuits pose a dire threat to hog farming in North Carolina and an existential threat to the livelihoods of farmers and the food security of our nation. Sherry White Williamson, Environmental Justice Policy Director for the North Carolina Conservation Network, grew up in Sampson County, the heart of hog country. More than 40% of North Carolina's hog farms are in Sampson, Duplin, and Bladen counties in eastern North Carolina. White Williamson said she left her Sampson County home before Smithfield built the world's largest hog slaughterhouse in Bladen County in the early 1990s. When she returned to stay about 2 years ago, White Williamson said she was confronted by a proliferation of industrial hog farms and the problems that her neighbors have been complaining about for years. White Williamson thinks the appeals court ruling may eventually help Smithfield's neighbors, but she doesn't expect anything to happen soon. She said, I think in some ways that may be a challenge, quite frankly, because the spray field and lagoon system is so ingrained right now that unless Smithfield is willing to take a different route or role, that it would be a while before there could be major changes that would actually be helpful to the communities that live around these facilities. I think that's just the reality. I would be hopeful that perhaps with this decision that it might accelerate things that Smithfield might be able to do to reduce some of the exposure and disruption in the communities of color and low-income communities that are exposed to all of the stuff that they are exposed to from the presence of these industrial hog farms. Will Hendrick, staff attorney for Waterkeeper Alliance, has been involved in the cases against Smithfield's subsidiary, Murphy Brown, LLC, for years. Hendrick is cautiously optimistic, too, and he says, the next step is to restore the same exact rights to people who are suffering the same exact plight because of the same exact company's use of the same exact system elsewhere. Murphy Brown, the company named in the lawsuit, supplies hogs to farmers for Smithfield and oversees farming operations. Smithfield has been owned by a Chinese company, the WH Group, since 2013. Reich Longest, director of the Environmental Law and Policy Clinic at Duke Law School, has also been working on issues involving hog farms for years. He said in an email, I certainly think this can be an opportunity to turn around the company's willingness to do more to protect the environment and the neighbors. Thus far, their strategy appears to rely on political favoritism by key legislators like State Representative Jimmy Dixon, Republican of Duplin, and effective public relations firm work such as the NC Farm Families PR campaign. They had excellent legal counsel at trial and on appeal and a conservative panel of judges, but they still lost big at the Fourth Circuit in a way that no team of spin doctors, image polishers, and political apologists can repair. Longest's lack of confidence in Smithfield spills over to the company's vague statement about its settlement. Longest questions whether a settlement had even been reached. Hendrick and White Williamson said they had heard only rumors about the settlement. Longest said, announcing a confidential settlement has been reached and simultaneously downplaying the magnitude of Smithfield's overwhelming loss at the Fourth Circuit is strategic. This announcement appears aimed at getting the media and markets to move on past this story without actually reading the opinion itself. Longest referred to the concurring opinion by Appeals Court Justice J. Harvey Wilkinson III. Reading that opinion, he said, is the last thing that Smithfield's public relations professionals will want people to do. Judge Wilkinson was an appointee of Ronald Reagan, and his name had been floated for the Supreme Court in times past. His portion of the opinion demolished key arguments made by the Pork Council, Farm Bureau, and Smithfield Foods itself. Smithfield did not respond to a request for comment on how the appeal court ruling could benefit the neighbors of hog farms. Kinlaw Farms sits at the end of a dirt road in the White Oak community of Bladen County. The road is dotted with small wood-framed houses and trailers. According to the appeals court ruling, quote, Kinlaw trucks created noise and dust ceaselessly. In a blistering, concurring opinion, Justice Wilkinson agreed that the lower court should revisit the punitive damage awards, and he acknowledged the critical economic importance of the hog industry in North Carolina. But he also wrote, it is past time to acknowledge the full harms that the unreformed practices of hog farming are inflicting. I fully recognize the essential contributions of the pork industry in general, and of North Carolina's hog farms in particular. I am also not so naive as to imagine that hog farming could ever be an antiseptic enterprise, but the record here reveals outrageous conditions at Kinlaw Farms, conditions that, when their effects inevitably spread to neighboring households, violated homeowners' rights to the healthful enjoyment of their property. Wilkinson wrote that a truck delivery schedule for Kinlaw Farms showed 11 deliveries between 12:30 a.m. and 5:30 a.m. during a single morning. He also wrote about the issues with hog confinement, lagoons, and spray fields. Kinlaw Farms raised nearly 15,000 hogs at a time. Murphy Brown stopped supplying hogs to the farm after the lawsuit was filed. According to the court's ruling, Murphy Brown had sited and designed the farm and routinely visited the property for inspections. The farm's owner, Billy Kinlaw, has said in the past that his farm was among the best run in the state. Wilkinson wrote, at the risk of replaying this theme ad nauseum, it should be observed that these interlocking dysfunctions were characteristic not just of close confinement, but of the lagoon and spray field system as well. The negative effects on animals, workers, and homeowners are here all visible at a single glance. He also wrote that waste in the Kinlaw Farms lagoons almost certainly contained pathogenic microorganisms and bacteria. Quote, when this waste material is sprayed into the air, everything around, including nearby homes, is at the mercy of the prevailing winds. While the odor potential from spraying untreated hog waste high into the air, where it then drifts towards nearby homes, is self-evident. Murphy Brown also knew of odor complaints from neighbors of hog farms with setups similar to Kinlaw. Wilkinson pointed to studies showing that leakage from hog lagoons contributes to ground and surface water contamination, and that many of North Carolina's lagoons lie in floodplains that make them subject to spills. And he wrote, at the end of all this wreckage lies an uncomfortable truth. These nuisance conditions were unlikely to have persisted for long, or even to have arisen at all, had the neighbors of Kinlaw Farms been wealthier or more politically powerful. He described how a moratorium on new lagoons and spray fields arose after hog farms threatened to expand into wealthy and tourist-dependent Moore County. The county is home to Pinehurst and other nationally recognized golf courses. Quote, it is well established, almost to the point of judicial notice, that environmental harms are visited disproportionately upon the dispossessed, here on minority populations and poor communities. In the minority opinion, Justice Stephen Agee said, evidence presented about Smithfield's assets posed an improper risk not only to punitive damages, but to compensatory damages. AG also objected to the district court decision to allow expert testimony from a defense witness, but not one from Smithfield. The prejudice from this error is so profound that a full new trial is necessary. Elsie Herring's great-grandfather was a freed slave who bought a sliver of farmland in the Duplin County town of Wallace in 1891. Over the years, she said, her ancestors added on, so the property now comprises about 60 acres. Herring moved to New York at an early age to work in banking, but returned home in 1993 to be with her elderly and sick mother, who died at age 99. When Herring returned, she found an industrial hog farm next door and all the problems that she said came with it. But no one listened to her complaints, she said, because that is how it has always been. Historically, this is just the way our system has incorporated people of color into the scheme of things, the policy making and decision making. We're left out, totally. Herring says she can only hope the appeals court ruling will help the neighbors of hog farms. I'm really very thrilled about the verdict, she said. I think it's important that industry understand that they have to be held accountable for their bad behavior. They destroyed the quality of our lives. This has been going on for the last 30 years or so now. So this is our time. Now, for this week's issue of Indie Week, the cover story is called An Ode to Ninth Street, and it's written by Rose Wong. And it's quite a long article about Ninth Street over in Durham. I'm going to skip over that. It can, of course, be found on Indie Week's website, and there are too many other articles that are of not greater interest, but they're shorter, and I would have to consume the rest of the broadcast on this article. I may get a chance to summarize some of the headings later at the end. But I will move now to Tomasi McDonald's second article in this week's Indie Week in a section called Etc., called Embracing Aging. The great St. Louis performance artist and playwright Keith Antar Mason says life may have begun with the creation of atoms, but cultures are built with the telling of our stories. Stories are at the center of the remarkable Durham activist and artist Omissade Bernie Scott's innovative work on behalf of black women going through the challenges of menopause. And those stories and lessons harken back to the black healing tradition, including her own. Bernie Scott, now 53, tells the Indie, "Ah, yes, we were little girls," her luminescent eyes widening with memory. "My sister reached across the lamp, and it kissed her arm, and it burned her. My Aunt Anna said, 'You're going to put some salve on it, and I'm going to take you to Mrs. So-and-so, and she's going to talk the fire out of it.' And we were like, 'What is she talking about?'" Bernie Scott still remembers the woman well. "She looked like she was anywhere between 75 and 100, she says, "and we sit in her little house. She pulls out the Bible. She tells my sister to sit down, and then, I forget what it's called when people open the Bible and pick up. Basically, she divined. She was like, 'Boom, this is the scripture.' And then she read the scripture. And then she took her hand, and she put her hand over my sister's arm, and she prayed. And then after she prayed, she anointed my sister with some olive oil, and we went on about our business. Her sister's arm, which should have scarred, bears a mark but feels smooth," she says. "That's a story we will always tell," she says about her family, "and the power in that woman's hands, the power in her hand, and all the Africanisms in that, wrapped up in Jesus." Bernie Scott's popular podcast, The Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause, is in its second season, and relies on stories and healing traditions like these. She says of the podcast, "If you unpack each of the stories, there's a remedy that's been gifted to folks, whether it's the remedy of forgiveness, whether it's the remedy of self-acceptance, whether it's the remedy of living your passion, whether it's the remedy of loving who you want to love, there's a remedy packed into each one of these stories." Bernie Scott's work deals with the wide-ranging impacts of menopause and aging, especially for black women. The largest ongoing body of research surrounding what women experience during menopause comes from the Study of Women's Health Across the Nation, which started in 1996. That study found that black and Latina women enter menopause earlier and experience more severe symptoms, owing to socioeconomic factors and other stressors, including systematic racism. The Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause first aired last year on Mother's Day, then launched into a series of community conversations in Durham, Washington, D.C., and Kenya. Coronavirus interrupted plans for a community session that had been scheduled to take place in Harlem in late March. Undaunted, Bernie Scott began hosting conversations online. Events for the summer solstice and autumnal equinox drew over 300 people each. One Facebook event attracted more than 1,500 viewers. During a September podcast episode, Healing is Your Birthright, Bernie Scott conversed with guest Karen Rose, a master teacher, herbalist, healer, and priestess who lives in Brooklyn. Much of the discussion focused on the benefits of plant-based medicines and how they can give women a measure of medical autonomy to heal themselves. Many of these remedies have been passed down through families rather than formalized medical practice. Rose, who owns the Sacred Vibes Apothecary in Brooklyn, recommended herbal concoctions for common menopausal conditions, hot flashes, lack of libido, vaginal dryness, skin changes, and stress. A native of Guyana, Rose noted that her remedies are based on ancestral herbal practices that were gifted to her by her parents and grandparents. Last month, Bernie Scott expanded on the podcast's success by publishing a beautifully designed e-zine, Messages from the Menopausal Multiverse, which rewrites the narrative surrounding the stage in a woman's life when she experiences a natural decline in her reproductive hormones when she reaches her 40s or 50s. The e-zine includes the words of local womenist activists. It also pays tribute to Bernie Scott's mother, along with other Black women whose work has served as a guide along her journey: Audre Lorde, Gwendolyn Brooks, Sojourner Truth, June Jordan, and Toni Morrison. The dynamic volume offers keys to not just surviving, but thriving while aging gracefully. In it, Bernie Scott presents her selfhood as the possessor of four elements, or Omis: earth, air, fire, and water. The fire Omi asks, what does it mean to be in this body at this time, to acknowledge what this body wants and needs, and to move accordingly? The water Omi asks Black women to reclaim your sweetness. The water Omi, reclaim rest as an act of liberation. Fight the addiction to stay in motion. Lana Garland, director of the Haiti Heritage Film Festival, says the festival will be giving the Black Girl's Guide a platform to have a conversation with a major television network next year. She did not go into the specifics, except to say that the network, quote, will meet up with Black girls in 2021. Speaking to the importance of Bernie Scott's work, Garland, 58, points out that as a Gen Xer, her coming-of-age years were marked by an older generation of women who did not talk freely about menopause. There was a reluctance, she says, like it was something that was shameful. Garland says when she was in her 40s and going through perimenopause, she felt like she had missed out on conversations preparing her for the first indicators of hormonal aging. She says it was like, oh my God, why aren't people talking about this? And it affects us all, our children, the men and women in our relationships. Garland says the Black Girl's Guide represents a paradigm shift of who we decide ourselves to be. This conversation is very, very, very important. We get to say who we are. Nia Wilson, the executive director of Spirit House in downtown Durham, echoes Garland's observations. Wilson says, culturally, Black people and people of color are used to honoring their elders for their wisdom and to learn what they have to offer, but white supremacy and patriarchy teach women to, quote, stay young, move quickly, and be productive. She says, think about how many times women run to get plastic surgery so they can remain young. I'm finding beauty in my body at 57, and it's hard to say that out loud. It's like a cognitive dissonance. Women are relegated to boxes as we get older, she adds. We still feel vibrant. We still continue to learn, grow, and thrive. We have to combat the boxes. Women are shamed for and shamed about the aging process. That's why she's grateful for the work Bernie Scott, affectionately known as Omi, is putting forward with her podcast and zine. Omi broke that wide open and created a voice to say who we really are, says Wilson, who adds that Bernie Scott's work is engaging black women of all ages. We're not just strong black women. We can be soft. We can be vulnerable. We are still being sexual, and there has not been room to talk about that until now. Bernie Scott says she wants to decolonize the crone. She asks, if you'd say, describe an older woman to me, or an older witch, or an older whatever, what would you say they look like? And people would say, she's probably wrinkled and gnarled up and white and lives in the woods and is mean and is isolated and terrorizes children. And you're like, yeah. That raises questions for Bernie Scott. Why is that who she is? Where did that come from? Where did that trope or stereotype come from? She says she's not yet a crone, defined by dictionaries as a thin, ugly old woman, but feels that she's on her own personal journey to cronedom. Because I'm aging, she says softly, because I'm aging. Part of Bernie Scott's journey is offering a contrast to a youth-centric culture that celebrates all the different ways that young people move, create, love, fight, learn, and grieve. She aims to show that older people have those same aspirations and desires. She explains, just because you're 50 or 60 or 70 or 80 doesn't mean you don't love. That doesn't mean you don't experience sexual pleasure. It doesn't mean you can't express yourself sexually. It doesn't mean you don't experience passion, sensuality, or grief, or anger. You still experience all these things. You just have more lived experience. And there's a sidebar article that's fairly long about Omisad's journey to activism, which I will skip. I might have time to come back to it at the end of the broadcast. But again, indieweek.com will find turn up all these bits and articles that I can't get to today. Well, and I turn the page to a stage article written by Katie Koop called Golden Womb, a production of the fringe show My Geriatric Uterus. The digital production of My Geriatric Uterus, which debuted at the 2019 Cincinnati Fringe Festival, opens with a Raleigh-based playwright performer Lamarev Jones as grown-ass woman. She is introducing a special episode of a fictional public access show, Adulting from Millennials, for her 35th birthday. The public access episode travels back to previous moments and sing-alongs composed by Christopher Wood, unpacking the student loan crisis, the difficulties of forging a career under late-stage capitalism, and the fraught pressures from her uterus. The uterus itself, created by puppet designer Samantha Corey, is a pink marionette outfitted with delicate fallopian arms, a cigarette dangling out of its mouth. Between sing-alongs and skits, under Carolyn Guido Clifford's direction, Jones breaks from the public access host persona, speaking off the cuff to the distinct obstacles that black millennial women face, not just in the workforce, but when it comes to motherhood and what her children may face. These moments of raw power, which might otherwise have played directly to the audience on the Cincinnati Fringe stage the show premiered on, instead occur in full view of the studio, revealing cameras, light fixtures, and the production staff. The meta-theatricality of seeing the scaffolding of film production is satisfying, though This choice makes you wish you could be closer to Jones in these moments, not viewing her digitally from offstage right. Despite these moments of distance and the few instances of issues with audio mixing, the experience is exhilarating from start to finish. Like any good Fringe experience, even translated to film, My Geriatric Uterus feels handmade, personal, and jagged around the edges. From the bright set pieces and paper-cut transition shots to the unmistakable industrial aesthetic of Durham's Shadowbox studio space where the production was filmed. My Geriatric Uterus, produced by Aggressive Curl Pattern Productions, is available on demand via Vimeo for a $5 one-time viewing through the end of December. Tips collected via payment apps go directly to the artist. Running at 35 minutes, My Geriatric Uterus is worth much more than the $5 asking price in a time when fresh, experimental local art is often inaccessible due to social distancing restrictions. My Geriatric Uterus feels exactly like what theater should be, even digitally. And next, some music reviews. We have three albums of Christmas sort of tenor and spirit. They're reviewed by two separate reviewers in Indie Week. And the first review by Will Atkinson is of Blue Christmas. I'm sorry, that's the title of the article. The first article is Josh Kimbrough, Yule Chime, Extended Play. And it's come out on December 11th, coming right up. Yule Chime. Interpretation has always been woven into the fingerstyle guitar tradition. The work of artists like the late John Fahey, probably the best known representative of the style broadly known as American Primitive, drew from influences as diverse as folk, blues, and Indian raga. Some of his best known arrangements were simply variations on others. The Holidays, of course, present no shortage of source material, something Fahey realized when he released 1968's The New Possibility, a collection of Christmas songs arranged for solo guitar that remain his best-selling work. Following in the footsteps of that album, Chapel Hill's Josh Kimbrough soundtracks the winter season with the Yule Chime EP, a follow-up to June's excellent Slither, Soar and Disappear. The new release features two original compositions alongside three Christmas standards, each recorded with the raw intimacy that is so characteristic of American primitive guitar. Kimbrough's playing has a way of teetering on the line between the familiar and foreign. On standards like Good King Wenceslas and the gorgeous Once in Royal David's City, the melodies are instantly recognizable, yet cloaked in enough unusual detail, the dissonance produced by the droning pedal tone of a bass line, an occasional flourish of ringing harmonics, a brief hesitation between phrases, to make these old hymns feel fresh. Occasionally, Kimbrough is accompanied by lap steel or a whistling drone, but his acoustic guitar work always remains the focus. There is an organic, deliberate sense of timing to these arrangements that, like the subtle squeak of fingers along a fretboard, conveys a closeness and warmth befitting the season. In the long tradition of reinterpreting Christmas classics, Yule Chime is a welcome addition. And Will Atkinson gives this Yule Chime extended play 3.5 stars. Sarah Edwards, the other columnist, gives a review of two separate albums now. Winter Mixtape from Sleepy Cat Records, also coming out December 11th. Ever since Mariah Carey's 1994 gold standard, Merry Christmas, the holiday album has become something of a rite of passage for artists. For the collaborative, close-knit Carborough label Sleepy Cat Records, this meant gathering its artists for a winter mixtape of original and originally reimagined holiday tunes. The resulting album is thoughtful, inventive, and very fun. And while the liner notes stress that Sleepy Cat wanted to make a collection that wasn't pious, there's still a hint of the holy in several of his Astral Laurel Canyon covers. A Trippers and Askers original, Christmas in Mumbai, kicks off the mixtape with a warbling, vulnerable acoustic ditty that circles the refrain, Hallelujah, I'm Alive, with gravitas. Chessa Rich's cover of Judy Sills' 1971 Jesus Was a Crossmaker touches on hallowed ground. The song has been covered by the likes of Linda Ronstadt and Warren Zevon. But while Sills' original was yearning and frantic, supposedly she wrote it during a breakup, Rich makes it soundly her own, with a clear-eyed, steady delivery that has a slight chill of the occult as sleigh bells shiver in the background. Next comes another standard, Joni Mitchell's emotional River, which was released the same year and also finds its roots in heartbreak. Mitchell wrote it while in the process of breaking up with Graham Nash. Appropriate to this year, the song laments a holiday spent apart. Where Mitchell's voice is wild with emotion at times, singer-songwriter Chris Frisina is patient, his voice deep and reaching as he draws out each syllable to its barest, most vulnerable wish. T. Gold's trippy, glitchy, 305 Till I Die, Christmas in Miami is, as the title would imply, an original. It's a golden ode to freedom and skateboarding by the ocean, with production termed lawless in the liner notes. That's reverb-heavy, irreverent, and unique. It's the standout of the album. There's more. A silvery Vashti Bunyan cover by Blue Cactus. A Roiling Kinks cover by Owen Fitzgerald. The Ballad of a Troubled Mall Santa by Earlene, who recently joined the Sleepy Cat fold and whose lacy, psychedelic vocals are astonishing and new to me. A full-bodied, orchestral Libby Rodenbaugh cover of Lowe's Just Like Christmas, and finally, an original by Josh Kimbrough, who has another holiday release on this page. It's an endearing, oddball mixtape, and it satisfies from start to finish. And Sarah Edwards bestows 3.5 stars to Sleepy Cat Records. And finally, features the Clam Pamp Parade, a holiday compilation from Do Not Gather, and that was released just a day or two ago on December 8th. If your first reaction when hearing mention of a pandemic-themed holiday album is skepticism, you're not alone. But a Clam Plamp Parade, a holiday compilation, which was spearheaded by Wilmington singer-songwriter Justin Lacey, and brings together originals from 11 independent artists from across the state, is full of surprises and rich fissures. Not always lyrically. The first song, Lacey's Newport Christmas Parade, begins by mentioning a Clorox bottle, hinting that an album of coronavirus crossword search terms will follow. Thankfully, it doesn't. The track, which recalls family memories of Lacey's grandfather sneaking gifts to families in need in Newport, North Carolina, is melancholic and opulent. The arrangement, idiosyncratic, intimate vocals crossed with chamber pomp, is stunning and would bring to mind Sufjan Stevens, even if there weren't a holiday theme at play. Annie Jo Buchanan's In These Lights is a sweet, crooning ode to gratitude and being able to come home for Christmas. Elma Nelson's Christmas Song, meanwhile, is a little less straightforward narratively. It's off the rails with a lusty, meandering address to Santa Claus and Mrs. Claus. But Nelson's deep, confident delivery is charming and perfect for a year when everything is off the rails. The chorus of Billy Heathen's Is This Still anticipates holiday separation over Zoom, as Heathen's deep, gleaming bass lines somehow conjure a communal feeling, a crowded concert in a sticky-floored venue. At just under 2 minutes, Durham, bedroom pop act, Moon Racers, Maybe This Will Be the Year I Move, is equally charming, with Autumn Ellinger's delicate, dreamy vocals meditating on empty streets and love gone wrong. Ellinger takes her band name from a supporting character, a winged lion, in the 1964 stop animation film Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. That warm, kishy sentimentality makes for a perfect penultimate track on an album with lilting, lo-fi production that feels reminiscent of early aughts holiday music, where all irony could be transformed into sincerity if you put enough tinsel on it. While none of these songs may become caroling standards anytime soon, they sweetly capture the raw, uneven spirit of a raw, uneven year. And Sarah Edwards gives the Clamp Plamp Parade 3 stars for this review. And we're drawing to a close for this issue of Indie Week. The couple articles that I have missed are an art article about artist Bonnie Melton's contributions to the North Carolina Museum of Art exhibit of painting critique, an article about her. And there's All That Glitters, another curated by William Paul Thomas, Complicated Notions of Black Abundance, and that's at the Lump Gallery in Raleigh. And for the balance of my time, I'll just summarize briefly the cover story. And that, of course, was Rose Wong's An Ode to Ninth Street, about Durham's ninth fabled street, Ninth Street, during over decades. And there are several sections to this, including things about the Regulator, Bookstore, Mill Village, early existence, Ninth Street and hub of progressive shift in the 1980s, of course, gentrification and all of those things. And she does close with a statement that mostly says, Ninth Street today is far from the dwindling Mill Village turned up and coming lefty hub where Mayor Shule and Campbell hung out years ago. The steady march of gentrification could bury those roots, she says. Still, I find my story aligning and intersecting with those experiences of the mayor and the bookstore founder. This date helped change how I think about politics, race, and gender, too. And I must close now just to remind everybody that this broadcast about Indie Week is available on ncreadingservice.org as a podcast, and you can find it there. And I hope you'll tune in next week for whatever Indie Week brings us. John Federson now saying so long, folks. Thanks for listening.